Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design. My name is JP, and I'm a software engineer at a tech real estate startup in LA. Today, as always, I am joined by John. John, how's it going?
Hey, JP. It's going really good. Yeah, my name is John. I'm a software developer for a home services startup. I work remote, actually. The startup's based in New York, and I work out here just north of LA. So I'm like an hour and a half, depending on traffic, from JP. And we are recording in early April. It's April 8th, and we are very much in the throes of coronavirus and everybody transitioning to work from home. I hope you caught our episode about work from home, and hopefully those tips helped you out. How have you been, JP? How are you faring through all this stuff?
You know, I think I'm starting to accept this as the new normal. Right now we are in about week five. It feels like months ago that we recorded that work from home podcast. And I think the first like 2 or 3 weeks for me were just very like I didn't really accept that this was going to be something that we would have to do for longer than a month. Now that we're in week five, like the middle of week five, going on week six next week, it's just something that I've had to like adjust to. And I'm starting to slowly accept like, hey, okay, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to go downstairs, I'm going to get ready for the day, and then I'm going to go into my home office and work. Like just that idea of doing that every single day for weeks at a time is something that now I'm coming to terms with. I think before this, I was very much like counting down the days, you know, like when you're a kid and you're like looking forward to your birthday. So you X off the days in the calendar until it's finally your birthday. I feel like I was doing that before, but for, like mentally for the end of when we would be able to go back to work safely. And now I'm just like, well, if I do that, it's just going to be more painful because like, who knows when it's going to be safe for us to go back to work. But all things considered, I think I'm finally starting to like get into like a daily routine of things. Like I set aside a space in my living room where I can work out. And I like,
oh, nice.
I like clean the bottom of one of my gym shoes, one of the pairs of gym shoes I have, so I could like wear my shoes inside. And just like, I think having like some semblance of like normalcy in my life and is like good. But yeah. I think I'm just coping with it as best as I can. How about you? How are you coping with things? You have like a yard and everything, so that's like at least probably helpful.
Yeah, I have a nice big yard here, and luckily our city has not banned yet like going on bike rides and walks alone. So I've been doing on jogs and bike rides, which helps a lot. But let's jump into our topic. What do you say, JP?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so this week is going to be super interesting. The conversation that we're going to have is centered around this idea of interviewing and hiring from the perspective of interviewers, because John and I have, I guess, for randomly, I didn't realize this, we had maybe collectively interviewed at least 100 candidates.
Oh, plus, yeah, for sure, collectively.
Which is like, in my opinion, not really like a lot, but I think it's enough for us to be able to have like good opinions on the topic. I mean, there's people who have interviewed like hundreds, maybe like thousands of candidates, right? Like if you've been in the industry for like a decade, I'm sure you've interviewed close to 1,000 candidates, right? But what sparked this conversation or this idea was this article on Medium. We'll link it in the show notes. And it's basically this guy who gives his thoughts on he reflects on the past 500 candidates that he's interviewed and the skills that he's collected over time, going from someone who is just like a beginner interviewer, all the way to like someone he would consider an expert interviewer. Yeah. And it's a really interesting thing too, because interviewing itself, poses a very interesting challenge for engineering teams, right? Because it could be an annoying thing to have to interview somebody when you're in deep work, right? It's just like, oh, you know, the only thing I have today is an interview at 1:30 p.m. And that's like right after lunch.
The worst.
And it's kind of in the middle of the day, right? So, you know, you have the first half of your day, you might have like a morning meeting, like you might have like a daily stand up. So you have like 2 hours until lunch. You have to eat. Right. So you don't go crazy. You're not starving. And then you have this interview that potentially ends at like 2:00. And then all of a sudden you have like, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours left of your day. And you're like, well, where did my day go? Somehow this like interview, whatever.
Yeah, and if you're doing interviews, there's prep, there's follow-up, there's note-taking afterwards. Like, it's not just the 30-minute to an hour interview. It's everything leading up to it. And it, especially if you're just like a heads-down coder, it's really challenging to have to stop your day and do that. And I feel like a lot of coders get into this job to be able to, like, go into the cave and code away and not deal with people. And then we get this huge interruption of just having to deal with strangers in this way. And it can be really intimidating. Even for me, I'm somebody who's pretty social. Like, I was a DJ in college and I'm pretty good with people generally, and it's really stressful and hard to get into, switch mindsets and context to talk to this stranger and go through all that. And so let's walk through this article a bit, because I really like this idea of this kind of problem statement. And so, like, that's kind of the first thing that we're talking about, which is interviewing can be annoying because it's an interruption from deep work, which is, like, really, really hard. And I think the other piece of it is, when you've done it a ton, it can be really, really boring. I think even for my last round of interviews that I was hiring for the agency, it got very rote for me. It was like, okay, who's this person? I'm talking to them again. I have to answer all the same questions again and again. It definitely can feel really rote and like it's not a good investment. But a good manager or a good business owner knows hiring great people is the number one highest leverage thing you can make. And so I think it's really interesting too. The author pointed out these two critical skill sets, and I've never really thought of it this way. You want to walk us through those, JP?
Yes. So there's two important things, two important qualities that a really good interviewer will have. The first of which is attracting talent. So it's like, how can I make this person that I'm interviewing want to work with me? Like, I need to make this seem like the most appealing thing in the world. And the second skill is like spotting talent, right? So when you're interviewing this person, you know, how can you assess whether or not they will actually be a good fit, technically speaking, right? So, like, even if they might stumble here and there and might, like, need a few little nudges to get on the right track, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, that they failed, right? Sure. Or that they did poorly. Sure. It's up to you as the person who's interviewing them to be able to make a good judgment call of whether or not, like, this person actually is really, really talented, and how can I, as an interviewer, bring the best out of them such that I can see that?
Yeah. I think the other piece that is hard to ignore, and this is the part for me that was interesting, was realizing that interviewing is about attraction as much as it is reviewing the other person. So making the role seem great and making you seem great to work with if you're going to be their manager. And that's the piece that it was in the back of my mind, but I never really thought of it that way. It was much more of like, I'm assessing this person for this role. They've already been attracted. Like, they fill out the job application. But it's interesting and challenging to me to realize I haven't thought of it this way, and I should think of it more of this way, that I need to make this person want this job. Like, it's as much as me selling them as it is kind of making sure that they're a fit at the same time. So then the article goes on to talk about this idea of beginner, competent, proficient, and expert. On that scale, JP, where would you put yourself? I'd put myself somewhere between competent and proficient, maybe in the middle of that scale. What about you?
Yes, I think that's exactly where I was literally looking at this thing and thinking, like, there's no way I would consider myself like fully proficient, but I think there are aspects of who I am as an interviewer that I would be like, yeah, I'm proficient at that, but I'm not proficient at like all things.
Yeah.
I'm still learning. And I think definitely, if you're listening to this, this episode, definitely look at this article that we're going to link, because there are bullet points at the end of this, at this blog post that basically lists like, these are the qualities of a competent interviewer. These are the qualities of, a proficient interviewer, right? So like, it's able for you to spot your weaknesses and be like, okay, so this is where I land on communication. What does the next level look like if I want to like level up in my communication skills, for example? So, I mean, for example, I'm interviewing someone today at like 1:30, actually.
Nice.
Or 2:30 or something like that. And I'm definitely going to reread this article just as a reminder of like, hey, maybe I can like strengthen this area. Of like the range of things I can potentially be good at.
Yeah, 100%. And so we talked through this a little bit, but you and I have both conducted quite a few interviews. So pre-tech, so before my world is going into the startups and having an agency, all this, I probably did like 50 plus interviews when I was in the corporate world. I was a supply chain manager. So I did a lot of interviews there, which was a very different style than after going into tech, especially running my own agency. But post now in tech, I've probably done somewhere between 30 and 40, maybe more if I think about even if you include contractors in that, then maybe a lot more as well. So what about you, JP? You said you've done like between 30 and 40 as well. Where has that experience come from? Is that from your time at Open Door, or where's that been coming from?
No, that is definitely so I would say about 30 to 40 interviews, interviews all at Open Door.
Okay, cool.
And I think that's actually has been within the last, most of that has been within the last like year or
so. Wow, that's a lot. So you're very fresh on doing this.
Yes, very fresh. But there was definitely like a week of, or there was like a time period, maybe like 2 or 3 weeks where I must have knocked out like 20 plus interviews. Ooh, we were hiring very aggressively. And I just remember being like, okay, I'm interviewing a lot. Like I am talking to a lot of candidates and I'm like kind of tight. Like there'd be days where my voice was gone just because of like how much I'd have to talk.
Programmers aren't built for this. Programmers are not.
No, not at all. I was like, I feel like a salesperson. Yeah. And as you said, like it's about attracting talent too. So there's like a portion of the interview, right, where they can, interviewees can ask you questions and it's up to you to give really good answers. And the person that I am, I tend to ramble and I tell them like, hey, stop me if I'm rambling. But I think that doesn't like add, that doesn't help my case of like, I lose my voice at the end of the
Got
day.
That's funny.
Which is really funny.
So I'm curious because I've only really hired in smaller organizations. So even back in the corporate world, I was in a company of like 40 people. So at most we'd have a candidate interview with 2 people in the company. We wouldn't have them go through a lot of people. And the interview processes were less formal at that corporate job, even than my agency. My agency, we actually came with a pretty structured format for the interview process. But again, it was only me and my lead developer that they would interview with. And sometimes they wouldn't even interview with a lead developer. So how does that compare with the Open Door kind of interview process? And like my main question there is your interviewing just a part of many interviews? And if so, how many? And what does that look like overall?
Yes. So yeah, exactly. So there's like, if a candidate comes through the pipeline, there is a series of, I guess like people that this person has to go through, right? Because they're talking to our technical recruiter for, there's a back and forth. It's not just like an email, like, hey, come interview with us. It's like, hey, let's schedule like a phone screen with our technical recruiter first, you know, so that they can gauge whether or not this candidate should continue on in our pipeline. And then we have like a technical phone screen, which is a lot of what I've been doing recently. But if you get past our technical phone screen, then we like bring you on to like an on-site, which is like a panel of like 4 to 5 people. Now, all of this varies, right? So like if the person who conducts the technical phone screen didn't get a good read, we can request like a second technical phone screen, for example.
That's good.
And then if you finally get through the technical phone screens, we bring you on to an on-site, which I guess we've been doing remote now,
sure.
Like remote on-sites, yeah. Which is kind of funny. But then, yeah. So I mean, I think that's pretty typical of like what a like a tech company does. So to answer your question, yeah, it's like it's part. My interview is part of a larger
chain
interview.
Yeah, but chain, how many people are in that chain? Like, how many conversations are there? Is there 4? Is there a dozen? Is there 20? Do you have a general number of what that looks like?
I would say at most you probably would talk to 10
okay.
people.
Yeah. But what's great about that, and I really appreciate that, because you're getting a breadth of people reviewing them, and it solves for that problem of just kind of like not an interpersonal fit, you know, and it allows the potential there is the potential to have more culturally diverse people because like, oh, you know, maybe you just didn't jive with that one person, which that's okay because you're talking with more people. And that's something that I really try to be aware of being when it's a team of only 1 or 2 interviewers, is just keep a very open mind about people from different backgrounds and different communication styles, because like, it doesn't mean that they're not valuable people just because we don't have immediate chemistry, and trying to find that really good value. But it's really interesting to hear the difference between a larger organization and a smaller. And in some ways it puts a little bit less pressure on each individual person in the chain to be a great interviewer. But at the same time, maybe even more so because you have all these other people you're trying to kind of compete with. But it's interesting. I think it's just good to consider both approaches, because some people listening might be in a really small org where they're the only person interviewing people, or 1 or 2 people. And you might be even in a larger org like a Google where they go through 30 or 40 interviews before they land a job, which is totally crazy. So out of all those interviews you've done, is there any memorable ones that stand out?
There's two that stand out, and I think it's mainly because it's like stroking my ego. But so one candidate very early on, she was very nervous, and I felt really bad because I just feel bad when people are like really nervous, because I try my best to make people feel comfortable. Sure. Because like this is like a social interaction that I'm also a part of, mm-hmm. right? So if you're uncomfortable, I'm uncomfortable. You know, it's like this
that
whole
can
thing.
Be really awkward.
Yes. But this candidate said that she listened to our podcast and she's like, you know, your voice is like really familiar. And I was like, that's weird. I've never got like people say I have a familiar yeah. face. And I just attribute that to looking like every other Filipino.
Oh my God. No, it's just because you're
out there. And she's like, your voice is really familiar. And I was like, oh, that's I've never heard that one before. And then she was like, oh, yeah. Are you like JP? Blah, blah, blah. She might have done research.
Yeah,
I don't
maybe.
Know if she was just blowing smoke. But
still.
But But she had said that she listened to the podcast and was like, oh, yeah, I even voted on like the book because, you know, we used to talk about yeah. books and stuff. And I thought that was really cool. And then another candidate recently had he was also really nervous, but he had thanked me at the end of the interview for making him feel like really comfortable. He was like, you know, I haven't interviewed since like I graduated college and it's been like 3 or 4 years. And, you know, I was just really nervous. And if there's one thing I wanted to take away from this interview is that like when I interview people myself, like I hope I make them feel as comfortable as you made me
yeah.
feel. And I was like, wow, that actually makes me feel a lot better about, because I don't know what it's like to be on the receiving end of my interviews. Mm-hmm. Like for all I know, people could be like, that was the worst experience of my life. But at least now I have like some positive feedback that, you know, maybe I'm doing something right.
Yeah, for sure.
But what about you?
Well, I remember one guy was so aggressively pushing for the job in the interview, which I kind of appreciate a little bit of aggressiveness. Like, I want this job. I'm the right candidate. But this guy took it to a whole nother level. He's just like, great, I'll start tomorrow. I'm the perfect fit. You don't need to talk to anyone else. And I was like, no, I'm going to finish the interviews I have scheduled. Like, I'll let you know in a week or so. And he was literally in the interview, hire me now or I won't work for you. And I was like,
do you think that's worked for him ever? Like, what is that?
I was just
that's
like,
just so aggressive.
I was like, okay, then this job isn't for you. Like, this isn't working out. And he was like, so upset that I like, he's like, you're going to deny me right now. And I was like, if you're going to make me choose you right now. Yeah. I'm so sorry, but that's not how this works. Like, it was very awkward and it was difficult to remain polite because he wasn't very polite, to be frank. But yeah, that was really weird. And then I also early on had this problem of like people really trying to negotiate salary during interviews. Like as an agency, we didn't have the best pay out there, but there was a lot of other benefits. Like it was remote, all these other things. But, you know, let's say we'd have a designer job up there for $35 an hour. And it was very clear listed in the job. It's like, this is between 30 and 35 an hour. That's the budget. Like if that's not a fit for you, don't apply. And I'd get people on these interviews and they'd just be like, I need 120K plus benefits. And it was just like, I'm sorry, but like, this is a waste of both of our times. Like the salary was clearly listed. Like that's the compensation. That's what this job is. Like it's part-time, it's this, whatever that job is. And it was just interesting the level of people feeling like they could fight for their value. And it was hard because it wasn't a judgment on their value. It was like literally that was the budget I had. Like I was a scrappy agency trying to get off the ground. And that was always really difficult trying to like validate that people are valuable. But at the same time, did you not read the job listing? This isn't 120. We don't have that. It's not that I'm being selfish or keeping the money for myself. We literally can't pay you that. And so it's a really awkward conversation a few times. But I've learned some lessons from that, which we'll walk through in a little bit.
Yeah, I attribute that to all the blog posts that you read out there that are like, always negotiate your salary, like never.
But also like the initial interview is not the time to do it. So
sure,
absolutely, 100%. I totally agree that you should negotiate salary. Do it when you get an offer letter. That's when you should be negotiating salary.
Yes. Now that
means they really
that you
want
mention
you
it,
and
that
they're
is
highly
weird.
Motivated. And that's when, and we should do a whole podcast on salary negotiations because that could be really interesting, but definitely your first or second interview with a person who's maybe not even the decision-making on a salary is not the person to be trying to negotiate the specifics of the job. And if the specifics of a job are laid out and they're not a fit, don't apply and hope you can change the job because the constraints aren't your value. The constraints are probably in the business. That's just a random tip that I found very frustrating early on. So let's talk through a little bit about the interview process. So for you, JP, what does it look like? I think you kind of outlined in a specific interview what that looks like here.
Yes. So the idea of this outline is like, what should a candidate expect if they were to be interviewed by me?
Yeah.
It'd be crazy if someone who's listening to this ends up actually being interviewed
that by
would
me. Be crazy.
Because But either way, even if they were, I tried to set out my like overall theme is that like I don't want to surprise you. So very clearly early on, I set expectations. I lay out a roadmap of what the interview is going to be. So we have an hour allotted to do this interview, and I try to respect your time. And I'll even ask you, like, hey, I don't know if you have anything scheduled after this, but I don't have any meetings after this. So if we go 5 minutes over, that's totally fine with me. But let me know if you have a hard stop at 1 hour, and we'll just cut it short. And I do that because I also don't want them to feel like they're rushed. Mm-hmm. But I also want to respect their time if they have something.
Maybe they have another interview after or whatever it looks like.
Exactly. Yeah. So I will lay out the interview. I'll be like, and this is like a general outline. Usually, it typically looks like the first 3 to 5 minutes will be like quick intros. And if I'm just doing a technical phone screen, then we'll just get straight into it. Because I want to give them as much time as possible. But if they're a more senior candidate, I'll try to like talk to them about existing projects first, because the hope there is that the coding challenge would take them less time because they don't need as much time. So it's interesting to talk to more senior candidates about their experiences and what, you know, interesting problems they've solved, because sometimes that's also important too, to get a good sense of like projects they've worked on and not just whether or not they could like bang out an algorithm. Yeah. So I lay that out, and then I tell them like, hey, you know, let's spend 5 to 10 minutes discussing this problem, you know, from a high level perspective and how you might execute on it. And then after that, let's spend 40, 45 to 50 minutes, actually pair programming and coding, maybe less time.
Who's the driver on that pair programming? Are they, or are you?
It's them. So they're both driving and navigating.
Got it. You're just kind of observing and asking questions. Cool.
Exactly. Yes. And posing questions like, well, what if we solved it this way?
If they get, and then if they get stuck, are you kind of helping them through that, or are you just kind of let them sink or swim? How do you think about that in terms of like watching someone pair in an interview?
Yeah. See, so it depends, and you really have to, and I think this is like a skill, as an interviewer, of like when to bail someone out. Because like you don't want to let them struggle for too long, but you also don't want to not let them struggle, right? Because you want to see how they think through problems and how they might dig themselves out of a hole, how they might debug. So you just kind of have to like prod and get them on the like nudge them into the right track, but know when to do that. And to be honest with you, I'm still figuring that out, because there are times where I'm like, you know, we kind of spent too much time on that problem that might have not been that like important. Yeah. Like we didn't need to struggle for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, it's hard because like, it can be valuable to see how they deal with that little bit of stress and how they deal with the thinking on their feet and how they articulate the problem set. But at the same time, you just might be putting someone through undue stress. That's like, that's actually not even how the job is. Like as programmers, we're rarely required to program on the spot. Like you have time to think about it, go get a cup of coffee and Google it. And you don't have that luxury in an interview. So I really struggle on that. What is the right level? And then, so the last step that you've got is kind of closing questions. Now those closing questions, do they come from you or do they come from the candidate?
Yes. So I like to set aside anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes of just like discussion. And I tell them, this is your time as well, right? So this is your time to ask me any questions. It could be feedback on the interview, how you think, like, what are my initial thoughts of how you did or your performance? Do you have any questions about the team you might be joining? Do you have any questions about the company? Cool. I will just be very straightforward and answer all of your questions with honesty. But this is your time as well. So ask whatever questions you might have. And if you don't have any questions, here's like my email address. Send them to me asynchronously.
That's cool. I have actually two questions to follow up on pair programming. First, do they have any heads up on what the code challenge will be? And then second, is it always the same code challenge, or does that kind of change depending on what context you guys have?
To answer your first question, do they have any heads up? Sometimes they do. I think the technical recruiter will tell them, hey, it's going to be like more app based, or hey, it's going to be more algorithm based.
But not like it's this type of specific problem.
Okay. No, we may give them like a general, like, hey, cover these topics kind of a thing, but we don't tell them like specifically. That being said, I try to cater to their needs. So we'll have like a coder pad, right? And you could choose like what language you want to program in. So I'll never force someone to like do JavaScript. Sure. If I'll be like, hey, I tell them I want to set you up for success. Like, what programming language are you most comfortable doing in an interview setting? I just need like 30 seconds to change a couple settings and paste in the correct prompt. To answer your second question, what was your second question?
Does it change? You answered it in the whole thing. So it's pretty much the same few code examples you guys choose from, it sounds like.
Yes, we have like a repository of different code questions.
Nice. So our interview process for the agency was a bit different, and it's looked at different coming onto Main Street as well. But because I work with remote teams first, I actually make the entire interview process as async as possible. So this is my kind of overall process I've found that worked really, really well for hiring for remote development and designer roles specifically. So the first thing is the job listing, a very long job listing with very clear compensation listed. Like, try to be as descriptive and accurate as the role as possible. Then they apply. Our last role got about 150 plus open applicants. So from there, I just create a short list. I always hide the name and email address and even countries to try to be as objective as possible, to look at their experience, read their writing, see how articulate they are. Just try to ignore any name bias that could come into play or any like location, because it is remote. Like, I want to find the best people, so I don't care where those come from. So I always try to hide those as I'm developing that short list. And the way I do that is I just rank everybody on a scale of 1 to 10, and then I go through and sort it and pick the top 10 of whatever those highest rated were after kind of reviewing the objective measures. From there, we invite those 5 or 10 top shortlisted people to do a code challenge. So they get a link to a GitHub repo that's got a problem statement. And it was in Ruby last time, but we are actually code agnostic. So if you want to solve this same code challenge in any language you're comfortable with, that's okay. You can do that. They get $100 and they submit a PR for that for review for that. It takes between 2 and 4 hours. So I actually pay people to do the code challenge. There's so much scam and bullshit online when it comes to remote work and jobs and people looking for free work and like fake jobs. I try to make them feel very comfortable from day one. Like, this is a real job. I value your time. I'm not going to ask you to do code for free. And I know that $100 isn't a lot, but it's better than nothing. I think it sets the right relationship from day one. Again, in that email inviting them to do the code challenge, remind them of the previous job listing, remind them of the compensation, remind them that we've reviewed their application, we're interested in having a conversation. The first step is this code challenge. Be as specific as possible about what that looks like. And also set expectations for that code review. Once you submit a PR or submit a response to the code challenge, you are expected to be available for review. So we do a code review on your submitted code challenge, and we expect you to be available for async code review over the next 72 hours of the next week or so. So, you know, over that next 10 days, we get a bunch of different code challenges in, we do code reviews on those code challenges and kind of collaborate back and forth. Like, what was your thinking when you implemented it this way? Ask questions about the code and about their approach and what that looks like. And then from there, we pick the top two or three that we felt like performed best in terms of objective code and were available for collaboration and articulate in responses. Then we do a real-time interview. So I feel like all of that leads up to the actual interview, which is very similar to your process. So again, when we get on the call, I reiterate the position, compensation, expectations of the role. We then talk background, career goals, and then motivations for applying for this job. For me, that's a big one. Like, why did you want this job? Then we walk through their code challenge. So we share a screen in GitHub. We walk through the review, ask questions like, what was the most challenging part? How did you solve these pieces? Where did this code come from? Why was it written this way? And then I allow time for them to ask me questions about the position. So the whole process leading to the real-time interview, we have both qualified each other a lot and really set expectations before we even have a conversation. And I personally like this approach because I used to flip this. I used to do the real-time interview first and then code challenges. But then I realized someone's pure charisma could get them through, even if they weren't the most competent coder or the best fit for the role. And so I like this because it puts that last piece of their kind of charisma or interpersonal skills as the least priority. And for a remote organization, that is the least important piece. If you are a fantastic communicator in writing, then I don't necessarily care whether you have this amazing public speaking skills or this, you know, infectious charisma. And I think it's important to put it in this order. But I think this is also very unique to remote position. But then again, post-COVID, a lot more jobs are going to have to be hiring at minimum for the short term, more remote positions.
No, I really like that your interview process, as you describe it, seems very much atypical of what you might see as I'm doing air quotes, the tech interview, mm-hmm. because it's not like, hey, stand in front of this whiteboard and solve this problem, or hey, here's this like algorithm. What's the, how can you write this algorithm to be the most efficient possible, blah, blah, blah. It's more of like, hey, submit some code and let's talk about how the job actually works.
Like this code review, what I'm trying to do is get to a point where we work together before we work together. Because time and time again, the most successful hires I've had is people who are kind of contractors, and then the relationship grows and like, okay, now you are like the lead developer of the organization. Like the relationship grows over time and you find that working style between, and it's about the work. It's looking at their code they're writing and is it working with the normal context and resources you would have. You are not required to code on the spot in this job. So why would I test you on your ability to code on the spot? I don't care how much you Google. I care about what kind of code you write at the end of the day and how quickly you can get that code out the door. So whether or not you do one Google search or no, or 10 Google searches, I actually don't care. If you're on Stack Overflow in another tab working, it's kind of okay in a remote position. I don't love the idea of that, but it's kind of okay in a remote position. It wouldn't make or break your actual objective performance of solving the problems and closing tickets and writing great code.
Wow. So this sort of falls under that category of how do you spot talent, right? Because mm-hmm. we were talking about those two critical skill sets that interviewers must have, one of which is spotting talent. And it seems like you've found a way that works really well for you. And I actually think works great too. I wish we interviewed like this. That'd be cool. That'd be really cool to like try an interview this way. But like, how do you spot talent? And it's by actually working in an environment, that would be similar to the actual job, right? Because we've taken steps as an organization in Los Angeles, the Open Door office in Los Angeles, to give questions that are more indicative of what you might see in your real life, right? So, or like not in your real life, but like on the job. So we do have questions that are closer to that than they are like, I don't know, write a binary search, for example, right? Like you would never do that. But even then, the environment that we set is still very typical of what you would see at other tech companies, right? It's like a pair programming thing. We're sitting next to each
and
other,
like,
or we're
remote.
Does
Open Door even pair all that much? So does this make sense to interview that way? Maybe not. I don't know. And I think my interview process is very atypical because it's very remote first. And I think I'm actually going to put this together in a blog post because at first, I would try to do our interviews following best practices of like how to do tech interviews from blogs. And it doesn't stand up in a remote environment because it's a different job. I think it's really important. That's one of my tips and takeaways is as much as possible, try to mimic the environment and culture of the actual job in the interview process as much as possible, because then you're actually testing for what you're trying to do. So you have this interesting question here that you posed to both of us, which is what would it take for someone to pass your interview? So for them, give them a high grade. I'm curious what your answer is, JP.
Yes. So this question, I think the answer for me is going to be a lot different from your answer. And I think that's simply because we actually have a rubric that we have to fill out. So after I interview somebody, I have to fill out a thing online that basically assesses them as an engineer. And we have all the criteria that you would expect is in this form, which is like, what was their code quality like? Did they communicate effectively? How is their algorithm speed?
And are you like selecting between 1 and 5 on all these different things? Yeah.
Basically the equivalent of that. Yeah. It's like a thumbs up and thumbs down. And like, there's like an in between and then you could add notes. Right. So it's like, there's no surprises there. As I say that out loud, I'm sure you're like, okay,
well,
that
makes
a ton of
sense. We use a system like that for Main Street. So more recently I've done a lot of like post-review like that. So I'm very familiar with the process. And that was previous in my tech world. But you're totally right, because as the agency, it wasn't as quantified in that way, that I didn't have like this granular breakdown of all these different things. So for you, the answer is it just depends on how they score my rubric, whether or not they pass your interview.
Yes, kind of. Well, I mean, like the rubric is the guiding score, right? But like you could have crushed the rubric technically, but maybe your communication skills weren't that great, or maybe there were like a lot of red flags where you were just like talking a bunch of shit about your previous company. Like it doesn't, you know,
there's other signs, there's things
like that
than just code.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes the circumstances are just like really, really different. Like, I had a candidate who absolutely crushed my interview. I love this guy, but was late to my interview by like 15 minutes. And I found out it was because he was on the phone. He like called the phone number. And I was on the Google Hangout and I was like, what's going on here? Like, I just don't get why this guy would be late. And there was just like a miscommunication potentially. It was probably on my end, to be honest with you. He was expecting me to call him and I was expecting him to join this hangout. And even then he finished the interview early. It was like insane. Wow. So it's like, you know, we didn't have as much time to like talk sure. through things and actually like cover, you know, more edge cases that I would like throw at him. Had we started on time, but even then I was able to see like, this guy's actually like really smart. And I want this guy in the next round, because he was able to like ask really good clarifying questions
and adapt to the miscommunication. I think kind of the point there is like, you have to be objective beyond the grading rubric in front of you and you have to think bigger than just the code. I do think it's important to try to judge on the quality of which they can fulfill the job, which is ultimately like, can they write code for here? But you're totally right. If there is like red flags about shit talking a previous company or red flags about interpersonal skills or not wanting any feedback on code, like there's so much to consider. And then there is this element that I don't think should be ignored of what your gut says. And I think in the past, employers have overbiased that to the point where you end up with like a culturally homogenous place and they overbiased like, my gut says this is right. And it's like, yeah, okay. But I do think there is an element of that, of looking to the big picture of all those different things. So for example, let's say someone's CSS skills aren't great. Does that mean that they couldn't be an incredible Ruby developer? No, like obviously. And I think it's easy to be like, well, the rubric says they're bad at CSS, so ignore them and don't let them pass. Right. So I think it's really important to keep an open mind. So let's kind of wrap up with some kind of hot tips or lessons learned. For me, I'm going to kind of give a little bit of an overview of how I see interview process. So to me, the words I would use to define it is like honest, unpretentious, and real as much as possible. So honest, never set any kind of false expectation and very much be yourself and try to have the organization be authentic in the process. Because the last thing you want is someone to take the job and then be like, this isn't what I expected. It's not what I wanted. It's so expensive to hire someone and then find someone else. It's a waste of everyone's time. So honesty is really important. I think unpretentious is the word I'd use. I want no surprises, no trick questions or techno babble. Like I want it to actually feel very, like you said, you don't want them to ever be surprised. And to me, that feels very pretentious when someone's like, I'm just going to ask this trick question. So you're like, we'll keep them on their feet. And then the last thing is like very real. Try to communicate and work with candidates as you would in the job. You wouldn't toss out a question just to stump a coworker. So why would we do that in an interview? You'd never do that. That's just a shitty thing to do. So to me, in the interview process, it's kind of a shitty thing to do. So that's the way that I feel and like kind of the guiding light that I try to keep in terms of interviews. But keep in mind, it's very different. I'm a small organization, have been for many years, and it's remote. So it's a very different environment, I think, than other interviews. What about you, JP? What's your kind of closing thoughts?
Yeah. So as someone who labels himself as like somewhere between competent and proficient, if you're a beginner interviewer and you're just like kind of nervous about these things and like you're just like, how do I judge? Yeah. How do I assess whether or not this person is going to be good to work with or if they're technically sound? My question that I always go back to is I try to ask myself, like, what is it like to actually work with this person? And I constantly remind myself, like, hey, I'm sitting next to this candidate. What would it be like if they came to me in the first week of onboarding and they were like, hey, let's pair program and solve this problem? So I try to see what it's like to actually work with them and to see how they are solving problems. I try not to let them spin their wheels too much, but I do let them struggle and I do let them debug. I won't immediately, for example, like if there's a syntax error, right? I won't immediately point it out unless, because I want to see how they debug, right? Are they going to just like haphazardly throw a console log in there or like a put statement and just like see where the code breaks? Or do they like read their code and you know, backtrack and see like, oh,
for sure. I think there's a lot of value in that. Yeah. And I think that's the one thing that my process does that I don't like is it over biases for letting people solve their own problems and not have to collaborate on their feet because we don't really do any pair programming. But again, I think that's because of the remote bias. So yeah, that's really interesting. I think it's important to find that balance between. It makes a lot of sense. So do you have any picks for us today, JP?
Okay. So my pick this week, I'm actually really excited about it. It's this app called Whimsical. I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
But I looked at it and there was a subscription, so I immediately like ignored it.
Okay, so the product that Whimsical is, that's bad grammar. It's basically an app that lets you create flowcharts. Okay. So if you've ever used like Google Draw or things of that sort, it's basically that. And you get four free flowcharts. So you don't have
There's a free tier.
And, you know, as a software engineer, you always want to make these charts of these like high level things, right? But Google Draw for me, I've tried to use it, is just the biggest pain in the ass because you can never line up the arrows. You have to fucking, you create a box and then you put text inside of it.
Are you talking
about
draw.io or like Google Draw? Which one are you thinking of?
I think it's the same thing. Didn't Google acquire draw.io?
Yeah, possibly, I'm not sure. But yeah, the thing is design tools, even like using Figma for this, doesn't work very well because it's not actually what you're trying to do. So I definitely agree that there's a space for a really good, and I love this flowchart software because Whimsical, what I've heard is it has that Google Drive or Figma style like collaboration, right? Where you can like comment and work together on these. That's cool.
Yes, yes, yes. And what I really like about this app is that it takes out all the guesswork, right? So you can just create a node going left or a node going right or node going up or down, and then you can split it off. I just don't get that with draw.io, or like I've thought about making things in like Illustrator because I'm just like, fuck, I'll just do this the really manual way. And then I end up like spending 5 minutes and then being like, fuck this, because I don't want to fucking vertically align text in a box. Like I shouldn't have to do that. Nor should I have to like manually make the box sizes bigger or smaller just so that like text is readable, you know? So I finally found this tool and I think it's going to be the end all be all for what I use.
I got to give it another shot then. Cause I just like groaned cause I'm tired of subscriptions, but knowing they allow four free flow charts, that's awesome. And if it really is great software, I'm more than willing to pay for it. So, I'll have to check it out more. That looks pretty cool. My pick is a book. It's called Every Tool's a Hammer by Adam Savage. And yes, it's the Mythbusters guy, but he's also just an incredible maker. Like he makes things like 3D print stuff and welds things and fabricates things. And he's this leader of like huge technical teams building really complex things. Like he did a bunch of the special effects on a bunch of the Star Wars movies. And this book is really cool. And it has tons of similarities to tech, just about like planning work styles, creativity, burnout, estimating. And it has a whole chapter on types of glue, which is like fascinating.
That's cool.
And just a bunch of random interesting stories from his special effects days. So I've been really digging this book. I did the audiobook and I'm definitely going to buy a physical copy to keep on the shelf because it's like a really good reference for like work and I've really dug it.
Wow. It's amazing how many parallels there are between like something that's tech related and not tech related.
Oh, for sure. In this book, like he's just doing special effects work and I can't believe how many parallels there was drawing and like really good takeaways of management and project management. So it's been a great read and it's super entertaining. So strong recommend. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. Hope our interview tips have given you some good directions and stay safe out there.
Yep. See you guys next time.